Always Leave podcast, home to stories that haunt. These stories may contain graphic depictions of violence or explicit language. Listener discretion is advised.
I'll begin with the day. It's March 22nd, 2023. I'm recording this because I have to. Well, because my dad died. Start again. I'm Ellen Lemont Briggs. My father, James Lemont, died on January 14th, 2023. He had cancer. But he was old, too. He didn't mind dying. Anyway, that's not relevant. He was an agent. It's ridiculous. Now he's gone, I can't ask him an agent of what, for which agency. But it was never discussed, and we all treated that as if it were totally normal. When I was little, he wore a uniform, so he was some kind of cop. But then I got older, and he stopped wearing a uniform. But we still had one of those magnetic blue lights in our car that he could pop up top if he needed to get somewhere fast for his work. I guess I thought he was a detective or something. Mom never talked about it either. There was no mystery. She just referred to your father's work, but not in hushed tones, not in a way that made me wonder. Mom died 3 years ago. Dad never really got over it. But anyway, I'm supposed to be clearing the house. My brother lives overseas, and we're not in a huge hurry to sell, but it needs to be cleared either way. And I'm recording this because of the files. There's so many files in the basement, in locked filing cabinets. I didn't find a key yet. I managed to jimmy one open. There's three more still locked down there, and most of it was boring stuff, old mortgage statements, documents from bank accounts he closed a few decades back, paperwork for cars he had scrapped in the 80s. But the stuff in this one drawer I found, it's wild. Completely wild. And I'm recording it so I can put it online or something. Let people know. See if this is something other people know about, because I don't even know who he worked for, and I can't find anything to tell me in the cabinet. There's nobody I can ask. But these are interview statements from a bunch of people all across the state of Florida, all talking about stuff that happened to them. Unbelievable things. Some stuff has been redacted with black pen. I'm just gonna read them as fully as I can. Statement of Elizabeth Archer, age 9, address redacted, Florida. July 2nd, 1989.
Mommy said it's all my fault. Is it all my fault? I used the crosswalk like she said. We climbed the ladder. I even said to Marianne, come on, we can climb the ladder. That's what Daddy says the crosswalk is, a painted ladder. That's the safe place. That's what they said. You can cross using the ladder. No, it was just us. Marianne wanted ice cream. I wanted ice cream too. Mommy said we could go to the store on the corner, but you have to cross twice. One road is just ours. It's little, and there's no cars. But the other road is a big road. Fast. Mommy said, now use the crosswalk, Lizzie. So we did. We went outside, and it was real hot, And I said Marianne had to keep her sun hat on, and she argued, but I won because she's only little and I was in charge. And I had the money for the ice cream. We crossed our road and walked along to the end, to the big road. And we saw the crosswalk. And I held her hand because she's only 6 and does naughty things sometimes. So we went to cross and I stopped. I don't know why. It looked funny. That's why. The bars of the ladder sort of wobbled. I thought it was the heat, but when I stopped, Marianne didn't. She pulled her hand away. She started to say something. I think she was gonna say silly. She always calls me silly. I pretend it annoys me, but I think she's funny, really. But she didn't get to call me anything. She pulled her hand away and she said, "Come on." And then she wasn't there. The truck wheels were there instead. I want to stop. I don't like this. Why do I have to? A big blue shiny truck came and ran her over there. I said it. It was horrible. They said it didn't hurt her. The doctor in the white room later said it would have been too fast to hurt her, but I saw it. It went bang when it hit her. It went right over her. The big wheels went swoosh, swoosh, right over her whole body and her head. Only her arms and one leg didn't go under the swoosh. It looked like it hurt bad. It broke her whole face right open. Then the driver got out and he was shouting, and I wasn't listening because the swooshing had been so big and there wasn't room for his shouting. But the ladder was gone. The ladder shrunk up like a drink being unspilled. And it was all only under Marianne. And her blood was leaking out of everywhere. Where the wheels had swooshed, she was only blood. All through her new Minnie Mouse dress and in her hair. It soaked everything red. But the white was disappearing it. I don't know. Like a paper towel? It was. I saw. I was there. No, not from her dress. From her. Where it was leaking out of her, the white was drinking it all up. It was moving again, like before, like a shimmering shiver behind the truck in the road. The shouting man was being sick. I don't know. Ask him yourself. Can I go now? That is the end. No, Mommy didn't come out until she heard the sirens. The shouting man stopped being sick, and someone else stopped and then went away again. To get help, maybe. Her hand was okay. Her hand I'd been holding. Why did I let go? Her face was too scary, all smashed, so I just looked at her hand. It was perfect. Her nails were still pearly pink from where I'd painted them on Sunday after church. I wanted so badly to make the rest of her like her hand was. Just perfect still. The white just soaked and soaked it all up as it ran out. I wanted to put it back inside, put her back together. It went away. No, when the sirens came, it turned into a line in the middle. No, white, not yellow. I don't know, just a normal white road line. Then it just zipped away, up the middle of the road, on top of the yellow line. Yes! Yes, I saw it. I did tell them. They just pointed to the ladder a ways down. I know that. But I'm telling you, it was the ladder when we stepped out on it. Can I stop now? I want my mommy. Will you tell her? Will you tell her it's not my fault?
Statement of John Winsome, 78, address redacted, Florida, February 11th, 1988.
Well, why are you asking now? I bet it still happens. I bet it does. I was 9 when I saw it, but I've seen the evidence since. Never as obvious, okay? Never as certain, but enough that I know. I know. Like I know my hair is gray and my teeth have seen better days. It's inside me. A part of me like my bones are. And I've never seen my bones. But I saw this. This is truth. I've not talked about it, not for a long time. You can try as a kid. Everyone laughs at kids anyway. They laughed at me. Guys like you laughed and shouted. And now I'm old. I can say whatever I want. But there was a good stretch in between where the laughs always came in the company of rolling eyes, worried looks. Folks wondering if I lost it. If I was some kook. But that time's passed by now. That's over. I'm already old enough to have moved from probably wise into maybe demented. I'm not frail yet, but I feel frail coming. Little quiver when I plant my cane. A hitch in my step when my weight is pressing down against the earth and there's a shift like it knows I'll be on my way to it soon. I'll tell you, but you have to let me tell it as it needs to be told. Agreed? It was the summer before I turned 10. A rough year. The start of the roughest years. The lumber place had burned down, and both Daddy, a lumberman, and Mama, who did everything from add the books to make the tea and clean the cans, saw their jobs go up in the smoke. Daddy had been there when it lit up. He came walking back down our road late that night, his face sweat-streaked with soot, and his expression one of silent desolation. It had been burned to the ground. Nobody died. Well, nobody died in the fire. Old Bill Evans shot himself, though, the week the bank said they'd be taking his house back if he didn't make a mortgage payment. And his wife Norma broke her own heart. Went after him a year later. Sad affair. Less sad for us, but it was tough. We'd never been wealthy, but that year especially there was no money. Never enough food. And what there was, I had to wait behind my siblings to get at. Since my parents were both out working or looking for work every day except Sunday. My clothes were worn thin, too small, full of holes, handed down from a careless brother and not new when he got them. In my memory that year is the smell of cabbage soup wafting past threadbare curtains into a dirt yard baked to dust by the unrelenting sun. that and the other thing. The thing I'm telling you now. We were only there because Mama had caught Daddy with the girl from the diner. In the house they were, though I didn't understand what the significance of that was back then. I started off thinking Mama was mad Daddy wasn't out looking for work. I was still a few years off understanding matters between married men and the women they weren't married to. We drove all day and all night for 3 days to get to Grammy's. Mama bawling and yelling the whole way, teaching us new curse words. I was the baby. The other two were already half grown. Mabel was 17, and Mama had a fight to get her in the car. Brian, 14, barely spoke anyway, and didn't make an exception to argue. Grammy's was an improvement for me. She dug out a whole heap of my uncle's cast-offs and dressed me in clothes that fit. Were a little large, even. And not full of holes. And the food was potato-heavy, but there was enough of it. And Grammy spoke up for me. At dinner, I always half-starved then. Mama gave me a scant ration. "He's still a child," she'd say, spooning more onto my siblings' plates. "Likely to stay one, too, Stella, if you don't feed him," Grammy would say, wrestling the spoon back and doubling the heap on my plate. She'd always give me extra dessert, too, if there was any. I swear I grew 4 inches those few weeks with her. But her and Mama fought the whole time. That was the year I realized Mama just thought she knew best. That it was just a viewpoint like any other. Her thinking she was always right. And she'd inherited it from Grammy. Anyway, it didn't come to nothing. Folks don't jump in and out of marriages like they were showers back then. 2 weeks with my grandparents reminded my mama of what she had awaiting her if she left for good. When my daddy appeared on the doorstep, crumpled from hitchhiking so far and holding dusty flowers and gas station chocolate, she forgave him. I think we stayed on a few days altogether, but in my memory, it felt immediate. Like he arrived and we went and packed up and left. Surely Mama let him eat and sleep a bit first. However it went, we left. Back in the beat-up old car to drive all the way back again. If you know those roads now, you might think they're boring. But believe me, back then there was even less to see. Mile after mile of shimmering blacktop, bordered by sugarcane, rippling like a vast, monotonous ocean. Days of that can put you into a trance. I felt I was asleep while I was awake. My brain was off the hook. I was just a big, blank dial tone droning on and on forever. We were almost home when it happened. No more than a half day out. Took us a lot longer than that to get home, of course. Afterwards, the medical folks said the boredom of it was what made me imagine it. The hospital psychiatrist said it was because of what my mama caught my daddy doing. The girl who came round with the toy trolley said it was something my Grammy had told me as a bedtime story. Between them and the school psychiatrist and the teachers, there were all kinds of theories about what made me imagine it. I was subjected to many hours of their theorizing, too. But I know they were wrong. All of them. Because I didn't imagine it. I don't know where we were exactly when I first noticed. A quarter hour before the accident, so I guess about 10, 15 miles south of that spot. It was never really investigated, given I imagined it. I was sitting behind my daddy who was driving. No car seats or boosters in those days. No airbags or seatbelts, neither. I had the corner of my forehead leaned on the glass of the window, letting my eyes rest on the regular flicker of the yellow line in the center of the road. It was like a gentle finger tapping a rhythm on my mind. Tap, tap, tap. mile after mile, tap, tap, tap. I was in a stupor, yes, but that's what woke me from it. The line went white. Solid white. My brother had recently started driver's ed, and I, trying to feel like I knew something of the mysteries he was a master of, had stolen his pamphlets from time to time, flipped through them to see what I could learn, some nugget of fact I could know before him. So I knew the center line wasn't supposed to be solid white on a long, straight stretch of road. For a start, this was a road with one lane going each way, so it should be yellow. And it shouldn't be solid. Didn't that mean no passing? It was a perfect place for passing. Perfect visibility. Safe. So why? I perked up a bit, looked more carefully. It was a solid white line. I wanted to know why and half turned to Brian, who was beside me. He was glaring straight forward between our parents' heads, watching the road ahead. As I turned, my own eyes scanned there, and there was a dashed yellow line. Instead of speaking to my brother, I leaned forward, rubbed my eyes like a cartoon character. But the view stayed the same. It was a dashed yellow line. I twisted in my seat then and looked behind us. Stretching away into the distance, a long dashed yellow line. I looked back out of my side window. Solid white line. I continued to twist and lean, looking ahead and behind where the line was as it should be, and beside where it was wrong. Until Brian dug a sharp elbow into me, a little too hard, and hissed, "Sit still, jerk." I opened my mouth to argue, but then saw the white solid line was now ahead of us, too. We were coming up on a long curve. Waterway was turning the road from its straight path. As we approached the curve, the white line doubled, so that there was one on either side. Together, as a pair, they broke left, guiding us across the faded yellow line as if there was going to be road work, some lane layout change ahead around the bend. But around the bend, coming at us head-on in its own lane, which the white lines had taken us into, was a red Chevy Chevelle convertible. They said later it was doing 50. I don't know how good they were at figuring these things back then. We were doing near 60. My father thrashing hell out of the motor to get home. I was leaning into the center then, looking at the white lines. So when we hit the Chevelle, I sailed. No seatbelts, you recall. Between my parents, through the windscreen, and onto the road. Now, I don't recall that bit real well. There's been flashbacks through the years, a sensation of flight, shining red flash, a tumbling of limbs. Everything had spun all around, so I don't know which direction I was facing, only that I came to rest beside the wreck of the Chevelle. A young woman called Betsy Cooper had been driving it, top down, her carefully teased curls protected from the hot, dusty wind by a white silk headscarf. She'd been on her way home from the salon in her new car bought for her by her fiancé. He was a rising star at the local news station. First thing I remember from when my memory of it all evened out again was Betsy's face. It was about 6 feet from me. She looked very surprised. Her eyes were wide and blue as the sky above us. She was staring my way, but I realized not seeing me. Her lips were moving a little as if in silent prayer. The headscarf had stayed in place. Her head, however, had not. Dawned on me as I looked at her that she ended abruptly just below the chin. Scanning up, I saw her body was still half inside her car. hanging out over the driver's door, spilling gore onto the asphalt. Her neck had struck the top edge of the windscreen and parted her head from the rest of her. The white line was under my head. I was laid on my side. My body was a mystery to me. I could feel nothing. Fortunate. Later, when I felt it all, sure was a lot to feel. But right then, in that moment of stillness, I didn't feel. But I could see fine. I saw the white line that was under my head stretch and run towards the Chevelle, forming a lane use arrow right where Betsy Cooper's blood was fountaining. And as I watched, the puddle of Betsy's blood began to disappear, sink into the white and vanish. The white line was absorbing it. No, it was drinking the blood. As I realized this, I felt a shifting warmth under my cheek and saw the line double. Later, this part was met with great relief. It doubled so that two solid lines ran from myself to the now lifeless face of Betsy Cooper. As I watched, I saw the newer line ripple at the torn stump of her neck, and in the same moment felt a strange tickling sensation at my own cheek. The white line was lapping up the blood that leaked from Betsy's head, and at the same time, a million tiny tongues were lapping at my face. It must be hurt, I'd thought. I must be bleeding. Started to hear things, too, then. Females screaming and screaming on and on. I don't know to this day if it was my mama or my sister. It went on so long, my brain started to tune it out again. I watched the blood all being soaked up by the white line and waited for something else to happen. After a little while, another car came. Felt the rumble in the road a good while before it arrived. Guess it gave the line a chance too, because before it reached us, the lapping sensation stopped. The shifting heat moved again, and the white line withdrew. The two lines became one. The lane use arrow receded, then the whole line slid away. First from under Betsy, and then from under me. When the driver of the first car on the scene walked over to see if I was alive and confirmed Betsy wasn't, we were both, myself and her head, lying on the bare asphalt. Not a white line in sight. Nobody died apart from Miss Cooper. Mama broke an ankle and needed a lot of stitches in her face. Daddy banged his head and went to jail. Both my siblings somehow got away with bruises and nightmares. The doctors were amazed I was so anemic, because even though my scalp was half off, the paramedics told them there was barely any blood on the road. Both my arms and one of my legs were broken. I was in the hospital in one of those torture devices they called a traction frame for weeks. Everybody asked me to tell the story. That's how it felt. Every person through the door would pull the curtain round and perch on the edge of the bed and ask me to tell them. At the time, I thought I was being heard, that I was an important witness to the thing that had happened to us. But I was not. I was merely an inconvenience. The police and prosecutors were sure my daddy was too tired to drive, and in his exhaustion had nodded off and drifted across the yellow line into the oncoming lane. Involuntary manslaughter. And my daddy said no. The road markings moved him. He was only following traffic markings. She must have been in the wrong, or whoever painted the road. A guilty man would say that, they thought. And maybe it is what he dreamed when he was drifting, they decided, that the road markings were moving him. Like dreaming of the can while you wet the bed. But I was inconvenient. I corroborated. So I was spoken to, interviewed, cajoled, and eventually threatened as they tried to make my story change or disappear. The two lines were what closed it. There hadn't been a sign of serious concussion, but the two lines, the neurologist stated firmly, indicated double vision, which indicated a head injury, and so nothing I said could be regarded as reliable. How seeing two as something they said didn't exist at all could prove a concussion didn't make sense to me. But they were satisfied by it, and honestly, I was relieved, because by then the questioning had gotten intense and scary, and this, even though it made me a liar, put an end to it. Daddy got a big fine and a couple of years suspended, but we had nothing to pay a fine with, so he went to jail. Killing the fiancé of a news anchor and all-around hotshot didn't make our family popular. I won't bore you with the hardship. I got out of there. I've enjoyed my life. But that's what I saw. And I've seen signs since. A crushed deer, bloodlessly eviscerated on a lonely highway. A crashed cattle truck. Blood all over the road, but the white lines crisp and sharp and bare of gore. I don't know what it was. And cars are safer these days. There's less chance of a bloody road in a bad wreck than ever before. Less chance, but not no chance. Anyway, that's my story. The truth. So help me God.
Statement of Officer Jason Hart, address redacted, Florida, September 18th, 1990.
I knew before I even got there that something was up, man. Soon as they said a car had been struck on the shoulder, I knew. There's never been no shoulder on that stretch. I thought dispatch had started on their weekend beer a little early. That was my thinking. Till I got to the scene. Yes, I was first on the scene and alone for a good while. The Ellis boys were out creating chaos at the drive-in. The other two units were out dealing with that. Three total, yes. Well, it ain't a big town, sir. When Jake Ellis was in juvie, we could have gotten by with one. When I got there, just a mess. A semi jackknifed across the road. An inferno of a car on its roof 20 yards down. And bodies everywhere. Oh, I thought I saw three, but later I found a fourth under the truck. That's the one still alive. I don't know, these teens, you know, they don't want to wear a seatbelt. What can you do?
Okay, so that's the thing. When I was coming in, there was a shoulder. A solid line right there, but it was marking the inside lane, not a shoulder. I thought to myself, God damn it, the county's painted the road wrong and killed all these folks. Made them think they were stopped on a shoulder that didn't exist. So when the semi came over the rise, there they were.
I don't know, the semi driver hit his head. He only remembers leaving Portland. Who called it in? Old Bill Jackson. No, he's has the farmhouse there, about a mile back from the road. Guess he saw the flames. Car went up pretty fierce. He didn't come down himself.
Well, that's the thing. Three of those bodies were lying across the shoulder line. On top of it. I swear to you, on my wife's head, that line was moving. Kind of wandering back and forth under the bodies. While they were wandering, the blood was vanishing. I've seen bad wrecks before. You know how much blood there is in the human body? Of course you do. You're a kind of law enforcement, right? But I tell you, there was none at this scene. The bodies were smashed and tangled to hell. Limbs half off, skulls like thrown eggs. But there was no blood. I was watching it go. Right under my nose. It'd leak out, and there'd be the line, and it'd just soak right in.
sure I touched it. Felt it when I got down onto the blacktop myself. Rough, like the tongue of a cat. And moving. Rippling a little. Sir, I think it felt me too. Because not long after, I noticed it was gone. Never saw it go. That was when I'd found the fourth kid. Was crawling on my belly under the truck feeling for a pulse. And I crawled back out to radio in again and ask for another ambulance. It was gone already. Just regular worn yellow lines where they'd always been. But there was still no blood on the road. I guess if he ever wakes up, you can ask him. He's still on life support. From what I hear, the docs are just waiting on his mother accepting it so they can pull the plug. Say, are you gonna talk to my higher-ups? Can you tell them I'm not crazy? I've been on leave for 6 weeks already, sir, ever since I put the report in. I just want to get back to normal, you know?
Statement of Firefly Magnificence. Actual name unknown. No fixed abode. City redacted. Florida. 11th May, 1994.
Oh, son. You want to hear from old Firefly now? You decided our truth is worth having after all. You suits with your ties so tight. Dimming your light. You'll never believe half the things we know to be true. We know the unknowable. The uncontrollable. Yes, that's our real name. And if there was another before, we don't recall. We don't think about the before times, no siree. Too loud. Too much hurt. It's the totality of our reality. We stay right here, right now, old Firefly. We have slept behind the dumpster in question for 11 winters, give or take. Well, when it's real cold, we take a bed in the mission. But it costs you, you know. Not the money. It's $8. That's 15 minutes asking nicely, concisely, precisely for a face like mine. No, it costs our spirit. They try and get in around our energies and pollute them with all their dusty old book and their babbling brook. They want to drag us in and wash all the vigor off and pray someone else is into us. But when it's 15 below, we sometimes risk it. We know it's never 15 below here, Sonny. That's the joke. Yes, we can see the highway from there. Of course. If you're going to ask me about the second bike, then you could ask anyone from around here. We've all seen it. Mornings we wake to it. We stay here to watch. It's Drifter prime time is what it is. We've been watching it the whole time. We saw something like it in Idaho, too. But that was only once. The Idaho thing, it was an off-ramp, sneaky thing. One night, we were sat out with a little fire and some good weed, a certain greed. There was a lot of honking on the road, then a crash. They couldn't figure it out, the police. But we could see, that night, the lines and arrows at the bottom were for an on-ramp. On and off. Both together, you see? That math don't math, no sir. They collided. Coincided. I could see his soul pulsing out of him. The boy from the motorcycle. and the lines of the on-ramp came racing to carry it away. Slid under him they did, like a cat's cradle, like a soup ladle, scooping out the red and leaving him clean and white as fresh snow. We told them, we know what's what. But they sent us on our way, threatened to charge us with possession. But don't we all quite rightfully possess the contents of our lungs? Yes, the two bikes is the same. One bike stays all the time, the one you see there. We know it's meant. It's the one that tells the cyclists where to be. But the other one... Now, the other one is just like the Idaho thing. Sun, is your head full of sky? We mean what we say. Sometimes there are two bikes. That's how it hunts the souls it drinks. Last week it was here, shunting, affronting, hunting. Let's see. The sun woke us, kissing our face, saving our grace. About six then, and old Al said to us, fire, there's two bikes. So we got up quick to see. It takes till about seven usually, and it was nearer eight that day. A few bikes had gone by, but they stuck to the lane marked by the bike that's always there. Always cares, never snares. Eventually, though, one will always choose the other bike. It tells them where to be, doesn't it? So that's where they go. The second bike always puts them where they'll be knocked off. That's just what happened. A youngster she was, this cyclist. We liked her jersey. It had lobsters on it, can you imagine? Her braid was so long you could have wound it around your fist three times and punched God in the face. She put herself in the lane with the hungry bike, and within a second, a honk, a bang, an SUV got her. She went down right by the interloping painted bike. It's a fast intersection. A few have made it, but most don't. And she didn't. We guess something got her throat. Her bike frame, maybe, or glass from the SUV. Sliced her good, it did. There was a spray. Al nudged me when it arced over, like a red rainbow. Scarlet volcano. Then she was in the road, her soul pouring forth, and the bike on the road under her swallowing it down. Gulp, gulp. We could almost hear it. However fast they bleed, it can keep up. A drip or a torrent, it's there, draining, containing, claiming what it came for. It stayed a while. Longer than usual. Usually it goes once a heart is stopped, when the supply dries up. And we've all moved on because of that kind of issue. We guessed her heart was fine, however hurt her neck was, and went on pumping the good stuff into the white's invisible mouth. There it stayed until she was spent. Until the lament. And then it went. It slipped out the way it slipped in. It bled across, used her legs as camouflage, to the white lines that keep everyone from changing lanes. And then it was gone. Then she was just a careless girl laid out dead in the wrong lane, where she had no business being. We know you don't believe us. You didn't even believe us about our name. But that's okay. It's still out there. It'll be back. And Firefly, don't need your faith. There's no grief in your disbelief. Only relief, Chief.
Phenomenon report, interim. James Lemont, AID 4816, July 10th, 1995. I inherited the earlier reports from Jim Deacon, AID 2854, upon his retiring in 1989. Initial investigation was fruitless. The phenomena seemed to affect one 278-mile stretch of roadway in Florida. It is possible another road in Idaho is also affected. It is infrequent. I have requested a file dive and collation for anything similar, but in 6 months, nothing linked has been found. All reporters state they witnessed the painted lines of the road markings moving. All reporters state they witnessed the painted lines of the road markings moving, first to cause fatalities, and then absorb the blood of the victims as they lay on the hard top. No photographic or video evidence is available currently, and with the exception of the law enforcement officer, the reliability of the witnesses is questionable. Potential explanations are difficult. It was noted by Agent Deacon that cave systems within 10 miles of sections of the road hold prehistoric representations left by ancient native groups, which show white snakes of exceptional length. Cave paintings in general are rare in Florida compared to other parts of the country. Deacon felt this might indicate a cryptid explanation, a creature which once posed as a snake but now uses the road system to hunt. I do not have an explanation yet, but I will note that the road in question was built by chain gang, and at times the construction was managed by some of the most brutal overseer teams in history. Punishment and torture were commonplace. Many died as a result during the construction, and a lingering effect of this inflicted suffering cannot be ignored. I am awaiting full lists of those who built the roads and those who oversaw them. Perhaps an answer lies in the fates of those men. This will remain on my active list until such time as a conclusion can be reached. This is a partial report.
Was written by Beck Stranger and narrated by Kay Weaver. For more stories that haunt, as well as a behind-the-scenes look at what we do and why we do it, you can join our Patreon at patreon.com/pleaseleavepod. You can follow Please Leave on Facebook and Instagram at pleaseleavepod. Our email is pleaseleavepod@gmail.com, and our website is pleaseleavepod.com. This has been a Please Leave Media production.